And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Anonymous sources. Anonymous sources have played a big role in the flurry of rapid-fire revelations surrounding the Trump administration and investigations into Russian meddling into the 2016 election and possible collusion with members of the Trump campaign. This half hour, we want to talk about when and why anonymous sources are used and how journalists should deal with information from sources that wish to remain anonymous and how we as media consumers should view reporting that uses anonymous sources. Joining us to work our way through the use of anonymous sources, Kathleen Richardson, Dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Drake University in Des Moines. Hi, Kathleen.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You worked at the Des Moines Register for some 20 years, mostly as an editor. Also, it's worthy to note here, you teach media law and ethics classes at Drake University. Also joining us, Steve Berry, Associate Professor of Emeritus at the University of Iowa, co-founder and editor of Iowa Watch. Steve Berry, welcome to you.
Thank you, Ben. It's good to be here.
I want to make sure people know that you won a Pulitzer Prize in 1993 for your investigative journalism. Kathleen, let's start with you. Why are anonymous sources even necessary?
In some cases, where information is very important and it's very important for it to get out to the public, people might be in sensitive jobs, be in sensitive situations where they don't want their name attached to the information that they're giving to journalists. They might be powerless and they might be afraid that their job is going to be at risk if their name is attached to it. Or they might be, in the case of a crime, for example, they might be afraid of for their safety.
Mm-hmm. Steve, what are the conditions? You've trained a lot of students in your time, and you've used a lot of anonymous sources in your reporting over many decades. What are the conditions that make the use of an anonymous source an acceptable alternative? I assume, Steve, that when possible, we always want a name attached, right?
Absolutely. I think Kathleen expressed one of the major reasons that you have to use anonymous sources having to do with the, a lot of times, not just the career and job possibilities and sensitivity of the source's position, but very often when you're dealing with national security matters, as we are in this particular subject, sources' lives could actually be in danger. So you have to protect that. And also, I want to reemphasize another point she made, is that this story must be, in my view, extremely vital to the public interest. And I think that is an important failing in the use of anonymous sources too often the press. The stories that we're talking about here, and I tried to focus on six or seven of them, I think all of them fit the bill of being of extremely important stories. And if I had been the editors of these stories, I would have agreed to publish them. However, I would have added more information about the anonymous sources. In using anonymous sources, the reporter, first and foremost, has to try to negotiate a way that they can or try to get the person to go on the record. And they also need to explain to the readers why this source has to be anonymous. And they also need to be able to establish that this source, even though the source is anonymous, was in a position to know about the information that they are providing in the story. And again, in reading these stories that I reviewed for this broadcast, I saw that particular criteria was lacking in many, many situations.
So, Steve, give us an example of where you saw anonymous sources were used well in a case in the past.
If you're talking just recently, I would say, the story that was just done the other day, yesterday, as a matter of fact, when Trump asked the Director of National Intelligence and the National Security Agency Director, Mike Rogers, to publicly push back against the FBI on evidence of collusion between his campaign and Russia. They used current and former officials who had private communications with the president. That was the attribution they had. And they did have a physical document that they referred to, an internal memo, that was written at the time that the communications were going on. That is, they were written when Trump was actually having this conversation. And then they had another source that that gave them an overview, but this was, again, according to officials briefed on the exchange. That final source in and of itself was kind of weak, but it was used more as corroboration for the primary sources.
Mm-hmm.
I think the trustworthiness of those sources is that they had four altogether, and then they had the existence of physical evidence. And then I think another thing that sort of added to the Washington Post's credibility is that they were willing to acknowledge that it did not know whether Trump's approach to the Director of National Intelligence, Mr. Coates, existed. They did know about a physical document for the approach to Rogers, but not to Coates. So that added a level of authenticity. That little tiny detail, I thought, did add some authenticity to that particular story.
Kathleen Richardson, when you're looking at more recent reporting, do you see the bar set high enough when it comes to the use of anonymous sources, or is it about right, do you think?
You know, I think that most readers or news consumers probably don't recognize or know that the use of anonymous sources varies differently from publication to publication, and even from one part of the country to another. You know, we see the news coverage that we're talking about here coming out of Washington, out of the New York Times, Washington Post, and other national outlets. Those kinds of news organizations are much more likely to use anonymous sources, and perhaps have different rules, maybe even in some cases less rigorous rules about the use of anonymous sources than journalists in Des Moines or in the Midwest or in the rest of the country. You know, I was, you know, like Steve is getting ready for this conversation, I was kind of looking online for the different news organizations and the policies that they follow involving when they're allowed to use anonymous sources. And in a lot of places, you know, like the Des Moines Register, the Kansas City Times, there's a lot more hurdles that the journalists have to leap over when they want to use anonymous sources. But still, you know, even places like the New York Times and the Washington Post, even though the journalists are dealing with people who are highly placed in the, like, for example, in the intelligence community and things like that, the journalists have to have significant conversations with their editors before they can publish.
If you've just joined us, Kathleen Richardson is with us, Dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Drake University. Steve Barry, Associate Professor Emeritus at the University of Iowa. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner in 1993 for investigative journalism. Talking this hour about the use of anonymous sources, how they can be used, and I guess we have yet to talk about how they can be abused. But I wanted to get your reaction to President Trump's remarks on anonymous sources, tying it into the whole phenomenon of fake news, and also realizing that fake news has two meanings depending on who you are. Fake news, I think, originally meant news that was not true. Donald Trump often uses fake news to describe anything he disagrees with or makes him look bad. Let's listen to comments President Trump made about anonymous sources specifically. This is from a speech he gave in February at the Conservative Political Action Conference.
I'm against the people that make up stories and make up sources. They shouldn't be allowed to use sources unless they use somebody's name. Let their name be put out there. Let their name be put out. A source says that Donald Trump is a horrible, horrible human being. Let him say it to my face.
Okay. Steve Barry, it sounds reasonable if you just give a sort of very brief thought to what was said there. Yeah, why not put your name to a claim that you are making?
Well, I think we've discussed the number of reasons why you can't in particular types of stories. But one thing I would agree with Donald Trump on is the very last comment he made is that, I mean, he was exaggerating, engaging in I think what he calls truthful hyperbole. But he was saying that he let them put their name if they are going to call Donald Trump a horrible, horrible man. Believe it or not, I agree with that. I do not think that newspapers or any news organization should use anonymous sources to express value judgments, opinions, even interpretations or analysis. And you should only use anonymous sources for extremely vital stories, like the ones we're talking about here. If you make a habit of overusing anonymous sources for secondary points, minor points for interpretations, that is going to destroy a newspaper's credibility on the use of anonymous sources when you really need them, when you are trying to report on a story of vital interest. So let's use them very sparingly so that when you do need them, people will actually pay attention to what those anonymous sources are saying. Oddly enough, this sort of surprised me when I was reading over these articles. I did note a trend in this little body of stories that I read. I noticed a difference between the Washington Post and the New York Times. And I think the New York Times, in these particular stories, about seven of them altogether, was much more judicious in their use of anonymous sources. And I found the Washington Post, even though I agreed with their use of anonymous sources on the main points of their story, I think they hurt their stories when they went further down in the story and started using anonymous sources for secondary points and using anonymous sources to express opinions and legal analysts. There's no reason to do that. It's not important. The story survives on its own when you make a major, major point. Don't ruin it. Don't reduce the validity of your story by relying on anonymous sources for unessential information in the story. And that's what I saw the Washington Post do much more than what the New York Times did in these stories.
Kathleen Richardson, do you share that concern of Steve's when the line is crossed even a little bit, it makes the use of anonymous sources less effective?
Definitely. You know, it's certainly a valuable reporting technique. But as President Trump's comments show, the downsides to using anonymous sources, the fact that it's easy for critics to discount the reporting that is done using anonymous sources, and it does undermine the credibility of a news organization.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an example of where anonymous sources was just abused, gave journalism a black eye to put it a certain way?
Well, there was the use of anonymous sources actually was called out in the late 90s, early 2000s. There was a rash of fabrication examples in the media. New York Times reporter Jason Blair was found to have either plagiarized or fabricated a lot of his stories. I think there was a reporter just about the same time at USA Today and Stephen Glass at the New Republic, and the reason why these folks ended up getting by for so long fabricating these stories is because they were supposedly based on anonymous sources that didn't exist. So at that time, anonymous sources got a black eye.
Mm-hmm. Steve, help us be more so discriminating consumers of news. What questions should we ask as news media consumers when we read an article or hear a radio report or a TV report that includes anonymous sources?
Well, I think there's several things they could do. I think the main thing is to look for the kind of nuance that I tried to articulate in answer to your first question. look for more of a better description of the anonymous sources. Now, that can be very difficult. As someone who's had to negotiate with anonymous sources about how to describe, that is a complex transaction that goes on between a reporter and a source, because if you give too much description of what the source is or who the source is, you give his identity away. But you have to be able to convince the reader that this source was indeed in a position to know. And if you can report that the source is relying on a physical document, like a memorandum or like notes that were taken in a meeting, that helps quite a bit. I would also, this is more of a recommendation to editors as well. When you have extremely important stories like these that are being published now to the Washington Post, I think it is really worth the editor's time to start, even if they have to devote a little sidebar story, a very brief, short story, explaining what the newspaper's process, vetting process for determining whether or not an anonymous source should be used. I would even encourage it in the body of the story that you devote at least a paragraph, which in newspaper jargon is two or three sentences, in which you quote the line editor or the decision-making editor. In the New York Times, for example, that would be Dean Baquet. Quote him. He is the one who has to sign off on whether or not to allow the reporter to use that story. And Mr. Baquet should be required to give, not required, but he should be encouraged to give at least what his thinking was in allowing this anonymous source to go through. I think also the reporter needs to be able to report, and we used to do this back in the 70s and 80s. You would constantly see reporters saying that this anonymous source had been used in other occasions and his information had a record of proving accurate. That's an important piece of information that readers need to know if they're going to try to evaluate anonymous sources. Then I think what we're talking about here is something that the press is constantly harping on when we're dealing with government. We always want transparency. Well, I think that also goes for the press when you're dealing with anonymous sources on very important stories. We need to have some transparency as much as possible without revealing the source's identity. But we need to explain why we felt it was so important to use an anonymous source and how we went about making that decision. That can either be a sentence or two in the story, or if necessary, a sidebar, a brief sidebar of, say, six or seven paragraphs.
Kathleen Richardson, before we end this conversation, I wanted to make sure we got to a point with you because you teach media law and ethics classes at Drake University. Under what circumstances can a reporter be forced to reveal an anonymous source's name?
Well, it's a matter of generally state law. You know, federal law gives journalists much less protection, you know, from being forced to reveal names at the state level. Like, for example, in Iowa, a reporter doesn't have to disclose a source or turn over information unless it can be proven that the information can't be obtained any other way, and it's really necessary to the case.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Steve, what are your thoughts, and you, Kathleen, perhaps as well, fake news has been such a big word phenomenon this past year, 2 years. I'm curious what you think, Steve, the connection between fake news and the way that it's used in a couple of different instances and anonymous sources.
Well, the information, I'm not sure exactly what Mr. Trump means when you use this fake news, because you use it in so many different contexts. If you take it literally, the information that anonymous sources provides is not fake news, especially if it's been proven true. And you go back to the Michael Flynn story that the Washington Post first wrote. Everything that the Washington Post wrote that was based on anonymous sources, that was referred to as fake news. But now the developments have come out, and everything the Post reported in that story based on anonymous sources has been proven true. Sally Yates has sworn under oath that everything she said, and those were things that, that came out in that story. So it's not fake news just because you use anonymous sources. As Kathleen pointed out earlier, there have been cases where anonymous sources have been made up, and those are horrendous. And there have been investigations done, and reporters' careers were ruined. And those are definitely fake news. But the things that you hear, the term fake news is being bandied about so much now. It's even referring to news where named sources are being quoted. So I don't know what fake news really means anymore.
Okay, Kathleen,
it means fake stories.
Right, Kathleen Richardson. We have just less than a minute left. How are you dealing with this phenomenon, fake news, there as dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Drake?
Well, as Steve says, if information is true, if the reporter is doing their due diligence and doing their job correctly, then the information is true, and it's not fake.
All right. We'll leave it there. Kathleen Richardson is dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Drake University. Used to work at the Des Moines Register and now teaches media law and ethics classes at Drake University. Steve Barry joining us by phone, associate professor emeritus at the University of Iowa, co-founder and editor of Iowa Watch, also winner of the Pulitzer Prize in 1993 for his work in investigative journalism. Steve Barry, Kathleen Richardson, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, it's Politics Wednesday, of course. We'll have an international view with Wayne Moyers and Jim McCormick as we, of course, talk about many of the places that President Trump has been visiting over the last few days and the foreign policy of the United States under this president. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton with help from Elena Thompson and Robbie Broad. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.